On episode 27 of the podcast, we talk with Bob Rivers, World War II reenactor. On Veteran Voices, the podcast, we like to talk about local veteran stories and with those who tell and share those stories in creative and interesting ways. Our guests have included historians, authors, filmmakers, poets, photographers, and activists in the veterans community. I'm Kevin Farkas of the Veteran Voices of Pittsburgh Oral History Initiative. Our guest today is Bob Rivers of Elwood City, Pennsylvania. Bob is a World War II reenactor, but specifically, he portrays a real-life World War II veteran, and that's his wife's late grandfather, Joe Yarzabinski.
Yes, sir.
Welcome, Bob, to Veteran Voices, the podcast.
How are you?
Good, good. I'm glad you're here. And joining us on the podcast today is our chief associate media producer, Brian Shimini. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
Good, good. Well, I have to say that we're recording today live and in person at the National Grind Coffee Shop in Elwood City. Bob and his wife, Jackie, own and operate the shop here on 400 Lawrence Avenue. So the next time you're in the area, we encourage you to stop by and have a cup of joe, as they say, or a tea or a pastry or a wrap, right?
Yep.
And a whole lot more. And be sure to visit National Grind on Facebook and give them a like to keep up with all their activities.
Much appreciated.
I have to say something about cup of joe. Now, I had a girlfriend years ago, and the joe for a cup of joe was actually her uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was her uncle. In fact, her middle name, Josephine, is a family name from, he was a joe, right? Mm-hmm. I don't recall his last name, but it was but that was her uncle.
I love it. Family name. Yeah.
Bob, we've had a lot of guests on the show who tell veteran stories in different ways, you know, authors, poets, photographers. We had a guy who actually colorizes photographs, old photographs. He wasn't a photographer himself. He just colored the images. And we've had historians on, of course. But you're the first historical reenactor we've talked with.
Exciting. Exciting. I'm honored.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to learning about reenacting and specifically why it matters to you.
I think it matters to a lot of people, not just me, to relive what these people actually lived, whether it's a great-great-great-grandfather from the Civil War, or in my case, my wife's grandfather that was in World War II. We all have a connection to these. And especially being a family member, it's a lot more of a connection. You know, you actually can talk to the family, you can talk and hear these stories that have been handed down and recreate that for the public and keep history alive through these events in World War II reenacting and even Civil War, where, you know, we refer to ourselves as living history. You know, we're living the history that actually happened. We're not a washed down book that's put out different political point of views or anything. You know, we're a real person that actually wears uniforms, that goes out and marches and participates and has an active part within this.
Well, I like that. Living history. That's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. Does reenacting tell a story?
Oh, I think so. Most definitely. When you go to these reenactments, especially public reenactments, we actually recreate certain battles or, so, you know, our uniforms will be geared towards a certain battle that actually happened. You know, most notably, the easiest one to say would be the D-Day Conneaut in Conneaut, Ohio. You know, we're there to reenact D-Day. And it comes along with being in a landing craft and running up a beach and everything else. But being a reenactor is, there's that level of confusion that you get a firsthand experience with. You know, you load up on the landing craft with your friends in your unit and you're having a good time and you're pretty excited. You know, that's what you live for. It is an adrenaline rush. And next thing you know, you're kind of thrown back. You know, when the landing craft gasses up and you have these airplanes flying over really low and the gunfire and you see the smoke and you smell and you hear it and the landing craft, the front drops and you run right up the beach, you know, and there's confusion. There's, you know, yelling, screaming, you know, they're blowing a whistle trying to get you to go up a specific sector of the beach and this and that. And, you know, you get a real like firsthand experience of the closest to the real thing that could almost ever be replicated.
I've actually been to the Conneaut D-Day reenactment, and I've got to say, it was very impressive.
Oh, most definitely. The last couple of years, they've had a German 88 anti-aircraft weapon, and it was one of the most like versatile weapons that was the German Army really had. you know, and you see that going off and, you know, you feel the repercussion literally go through your body and you're running up, you know, and there's foxholes, you're running and jumping and, you know, someone may take a hit and fall over, you know, it's, you can't not get into it. You know, you can't not feel that adrenaline rush and, you know, you're sweating, you're in a wool uniform, you know, and it definitely gives you like a whole new respect for history. You know, it's like taking a history buff to the next step. You're not just reading a book. You're not just watching a TV show on the History Channel or a movie. You're actually living it and doing it and, you know, participating.
These reenactment events, now, they're specific to a particular battle or a particular event. I mean, it's just not people showing up and then saying, well, let's just, you know, let's just go through the motions here. They have a focus to them, a sort of a topic or a subject or a theme in particular?
Yes, sir. Some of the battles, really, the local terrain where these battles are held mimic the terrain of the actual battle. So like you have your D-Day Conneaut, which is, I'm from that area. I was born in Conneaut, Ohio. And that, you know, you have probably like 300 yards of flat beach that kind of grades up into an overlook and almost similar to the landing zones in Normandy. One of the other ones I took part in is Old Bedford Village. We did like a later war impression of, you know, when they actually were in the countrysides, town to town, you know, you wear a uniform specific to that. It's a lot more structured than people would think. You know, it's not like we just show up and, you know, you're the good guys, we're the bad guys, and we go pretend to overtake each other. You know, it's a little more structured than that.
Well, how do you figure out who's the good guys, the bad guys? How's that work?
Uniforms. Thankfully, you know, it's like, you know, you have the home team and the away team.
I've also been to that exact reenactment as well. And we got there about an hour and a half beforehand to set up our camera equipment and everything. And they had a big, like, team meeting where you had the Axis guys and the Allied guys basically lined up in front of each other, and the guy in charge was basically letting them know a rough structure of how it was going to go. And it was really, really interesting to see, because I was under that impression that everybody just showed up and just started shooting guns. You
know? Yeah, no. It's and it's a lot of fun. That Old Bedford Village that you were at is actually more like a tactical battle. So in that case, of that day, some units go left, some units go right. The Axis kind of, you know, goes off another way, and you know, you're kind of given a objective of taking a town or defending the town, you know, by any means, you know, almost necessary. You know, you can go off script and run around and do whatever you need to do. But when you do something like that, they have referees, you know, they kind of patrol around, you know, and it makes it a lot more difficult. You know, if you say defend a village, you know, it's a, oh, you know, we can do that. We'll set up here, and, you know, over there and watch. And then, you know, next thing you know, they're coming from behind and you're getting flanked. And, you know, it's definitely puts it into a perspective. Yeah, that particular battle, we were walking down by the little river that runs through the property. And I was kind of in front. There was two guys in front of me, and there was a guy hunkered down behind a tree with a machine gun. You know, didn't even see him, you know, but it puts it in that reality of, you know, when you're walking through looking and then you hear, you know, gunfire, you know, bang, bang, bang. You're like, oh, you know, got to run, you know, take cover.
I was actually following your group with a camera in that very creek bed, looking up as a bunch of dudes in German uniforms are shooting down at you guys. And I'm thinking to myself, like, wow.
Mm-hmm. It puts it in perspective real quick.
So you really get that feeling like this is what it must have been like.
I did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, most definitely. They had a mortar there, and you know, they actually launch off and make little puff clouds and stuff like that, you know, and you're running and you trying to take cover and stuff, you know, it's pretty real. You know, it gets your adrenaline flowing, you run a little faster, and you know, you're a little keener when you you know, scan the distance for any movement and stuff like that.
Wow.
The officer in charge, he was it looked like he was in like a Kriegsmarine uniform almost, the German Navy or something. Mm-hmm. The dude in the black leather coat.
Yeah.
I didn't get this on film, unfortunately, but I saw him like walking to go and talk to one of the referees or something, and a stray, I guess, explosive, quote unquote, landed next to him, and he like threw himself through the air and like landed in some bushes.
Yeah.
You know, like they were getting into it. It was so much fun to see that.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And, you know, those tacticals, that's what we refer to them as, is they're fun. You know, it's kind of like closed to the public, so it's only reenactors and you have fun. And actually later that day, we kind of, they switched it up and had the Germans and Americans fighting against the Russians, which, you know, I'm sure if some generals had their way, that would have happened, you know, but, you know, there's a level of fun with it too. And that was just that particular tactical, you know, I've been to ones where it's almost like capture the flag. They have referees out there and there's little posts that they give you an idea where they are, but then you're just playing capture the flag with tanks, allied versus axis, you know, different things like that. And that's, you know, it's a different level of fun. And another, that particular one too, I remember they captured a couple of our guys and we were trying to find them. And I kind of went around and I'm like, yeah, I didn't think anyone was there. And I go walking and all of a sudden I hear like a couple like gunshots and I kind of drop down and he's like, oh, you know, you're dead. I got you. And I didn't even see him, you know, didn't even see him at all.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got into it and how frequently mm-hmm. That you go to these events.
Yeah. So, I've always been a huge history buff ever since I was a kid. Went to a few Civil War reenactments that got really hot in the 90s, thanks to like Gettysburg. You know, the in the reenacting world, Hollywood sometimes dictates what's you know, really popular. And so in the 90s, Gettysburg came out. A lot of people were into the Civil War and all that. And so I was really into that. I went to a couple Civil War reenactments. And I was like, wow, you know, this is really cool. It's something I want to do, piqued my interest. Unfortunately, I was too young to carry a gun. I think at that time you had to be a minimum of like 16 or 18. I can't remember, but kind of fell out of that with school and going to college and stuff. And being from Conneaut, Ohio, I was at the first ever D-Day reenactment. And that was something to see then, 15 years ago, I think it's been going on, somewhere around there. And about 200 reenactors or so, a couple hundred spectators, to now there's 1,500 reenactors, you know, 20,000 plus spectators, you know.
Wow, that's huge.
And Betsy over there and all her volunteers do a great job of that. It's a lot of fun. But that kind of got me into it. Owning my own coffee shop, actually one of my best friends that comes in is a World War II veteran. And he would kind of tell me stories after befriending him and things like that. And it, you know, fueled me, you know, now I'm an adult, I can do these things, you know, so it kind of thrusted me into that. I had a couple friends that were reenactors and they kind of gave me a rundown list of your basic equipment to buy and kind of gave me pointers on how to get started in it. And one of them was to find an impression, you know, someone to kind of portray. So when you go to these events, you're not just, you know, Bob Rivers by day and, you know, a infantrymen by the every other weekend or something. There's a little more to it. And that's where I kind of fell into portraying my grandfather or my wife's grandfather. He was in World War II and I would ask the family and stuff and they knew that he served and things like that, but they didn't really know like a lot because he didn't talk about it. Just like a lot of war veterans, they came home and that was it even up to today. You know, they kind of leave it at that. And unfortunately things that are diagnosed now is like PTSD, things like that were almost unknown then. They just referred to it as battle fatigue. And what do? You go to the bar with your friends and drink and that was it. You know, that was the reality of the soldiers then. So, you know, I kind of took on his persona and started doing a lot of research of what he did, where was he? And unfortunately in St. Louis, the World War II records, the building that it was in caught on fire. So a lot of the records have been destroyed and stuff. So now it's down to like digital things that may not be as detailed as you want them to be. So then you have to dig a little more and dig a little more and dig a little more and find out as much as you can. But there is also a limit on some things that were, you know, unfortunately destroyed within the fire.
Is it typical for reenactors to adopt a persona of a real veteran?
Some do and some don't. That's why we refer to ourselves as like living history. You know, some people go just to reenact whatever, you know, staff sergeant, World War II, MP, you know, whatever they want to do. And then some people take it a little bit further. It makes it a little more gratifying for sure. My wife's grandfather, for instance, when I found out a lot of information and showed the family and they were, you know, really just blown away at the stuff I found out about their dad that they just had no idea about. You know, that's really cool. Really cool. Me personally, I'm part of a unit, the 4th Infantry Division. They're based in like central PA, Altoona area. And two of the founding guys, Jared and Mark Frederick, they started the unit because of their grandfather. Their grandfather was in the 4th Infantry Division. And, you know, they just it kind of piqued their interest and kind of ran with it and you know, started a unit around them. And, you know, it's just a great group of guys. And we go around and do our best to bring honor to these guys that actually, like, you know, fought and served and did the duty so we can say what we want to today.
Are there some people that, in your opinion, get a little over the top with things?
Most definitely. I think that's in anything you do. It doesn't matter what you do. There's some people that take it to an extreme. just like reenacting, there's some hardcore people that do that. They go to tacticals and, you know, or they'll go to events, even down to Civil War. I have friends that do this, and some of their friends refuse to even bring food, snacks, anything. And they're, you know, we'll go in the woods and scavenge for, you know, food and do this and that. And,
really?
Yeah. And it's like, you know, and then there's guys kind of like me where I'm into it for the history. I'm there to respect and pay honors, but also, you know, I have to go home in a couple days too. You know, I'm not going to starve to death for the weekend to see what it's really like. But that's also up to the individual. And I've definitely seen more as a spectator, some of the extremes. Like for an example, one of the D-Day Conneauts a few years ago, there was my college roommate at the time was asking this German reenactor about, you know, his equipment, his uniform and everything like that. And he had his two kids dressed up as Hitler Youth. And wow. I was even like, you know, that's a little intense. I don't know about that. And,
I've seen a few people dressed like that when I was there as well.
Yeah. And, you know, those people kind of, I think, weed themselves out. You know, everyone asks, they're like, oh, you know, neo-Nazis and things like that. And you try to justify them, but also those people kind of weed themselves out of the situations or, you know, it's one of those topics that you have to kind of be blunt about too, of like, you know, you can't do that.
Well, who polices, if that's the right word to put it, who polices the historical accuracy, the code of behavior during these events?
So, you know, sometimes, most of the time that's up to your unit commander or your CO. We go through authenticity checks all the time. Like he was talking about at Old Bedford Village where we're lined up, you know, kind of staring at each other, waiting for the battle to start. And, you know, they go through and check and make sure, you know, you have, you're at least era. You know, there are some things that no one would really know, I guess, you know, like if you have a really, you know, do you have a USMC boondockers on or American rough out, you know, or US Army rough outs? You know, no one will really go that detailed. Some do, but, you know, there's little cards they check off to make sure, you know, you're in full uniform. They check all your ammo, you know, to make sure that it's all blank. There's no, you know, live fire. And then, you know, it's kind of managed up from that. You know, if there's a problem, your CO takes it to, you know, who he is, you know, told to bring these problems to and you know, chain of command, you know, just almost like a real army.
So certainly there are people reenacting Revolutionary War figures and Civil War.
World War One,
World War Two, as you
World
do.
World War II.
Well, let me ask you, how contemporary does reenacting get? I mean, I have heard of some Vietnam reenacting groups, but I don't hear too much about them.
Yeah, that's still kind of, it's one of those things that I think with the general public that there's a cutoff, you know, is it too early for that yet? And especially Vietnam being such a, almost like the first heavily publicized war, you know, if anything happened over there, it was broadcasted within 20 minutes on an American news network. You know, there was a lot of political driven things, right and wrong, whereas some of the past wars before that were, it was almost cut and dry. It's just what you did, what you had to do. World War II, World War One, Revolutionary War, Civil War, you know, you were on one side or the other. So there's definitely Vietnam reenactments. There's not as many, but I think, you know, through the years, it may be gaining popularity just because now it's like my grandfather served in Vietnam, all three of my grandfathers. So it's like, now I'm a little interested in it. I'm not necessarily going to go out and buy a, you know, a 82nd Airborne Ranger uniform like my grandfather wore and this and that, but that's not to say my son won't, you know, because now it's almost like a generation removed.
Mm-hmm. It's almost less glamorous, if you will, than the previous conflicts. Like, yeah. It's not as like romanticized almost.
Oh, most definitely.
Well, that raises a question. Do reenactments tend to romanticize these military periods? And when we talk about the Vietnam War, you know, we're not so quick to romanticize that because, you know, it's contemporary history for many of us, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I certainly remember the war. So is that a factor, romanticizing these periods?
Oh, I think so, most definitely.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing to get people interested. Mm. The bad part is when they come and they see the reality of it, like what isn't romantic about it, of walking through an access camp and, you know, they're not raising up a Third Reich flag, but, you know, they see people dressed as Germans and they have German haircuts and they have uniforms on and stuff. Then they're kind of taken aback of like, whoa. But that's the part of why we do it, is to show them that it's not just romanticized. It's not just what's in the movies. It's not just what's in a textbook. There's a reality factor.
And seeing that makes it visceral, very mm-hmm. real. You know, I have to say, and you know, I'd mentioned this to you before when we first met, I used to think reenactment stuff was hokey. Mm-hmm. I just really thought it was overly romanticized, and I didn't, it just wasn't something that I thought was serious. I don't think that way anymore. And here's why. This is three-dimensional history, mm-hmm. right? It's the only time we will be able to see what the soldiers saw in three dimensions, really. You know, what mm-hmm. that tank looks like, what it sounds like, what the smell of gunpowder is in your nostrils, the deafening roar of a cannon. It's the closest we're going to get, really. Mm-hmm. So I've really changed my tune over the years, and I now say this is an important part of public contemporary living history.
Yeah. And, you know, one of like my friend Joe, I was telling you about, he's 95. He was in the Pacific. He was a bombardier on a B-24 called the Curly Bird. You know, I brought it up to him before I really got heavily into it. And I was like, what do you think about it? You lived it. You know, what's your idea? Tell me what you're thinking. At first, that's how he was too. He was like, you know, why the hell would you want to do that? You know, I lived it. You know, we did it. You know, we fought so you wouldn't have to worry about these things again, and you're bringing it back up. And I think that was the first reaction. And it was a day or two later, he came back, and after my first event, and he asked me how it went, and we just started talking. And then it was almost on a different level. He's like, you know, after I thought about it, I can understand why you would want to do it. I appreciate that you do it. So that way, you know, my best friend that was killed wasn't in vain. The things that I had to do, you know, wasn't forgotten. You know, it's continued on, and he's really receptive of it. If he could travel, I would love to, you know, take him up there and plop him down and see. And he's even, you know, if he said if he could travel, he would be open to it. But unfortunately, you know, the World War II veterans are slowly decreasing. You know, it's an unfortunate reality. So you got to get that oral history, the things that they saw before it's too late. We can all open up a history book and read about Vietnam, read about World War II. You know, World War I, you know, maybe some people can remember their grandparents talking about it, but, you know, that's really about it. There's no oral history, essentially. Everything now is written. There's no storytelling of what they smelled, what they ate, what happened, you know, maybe a funny moment, And that's what I carry on in my persona as Joe Yarzbinski in World War II is I kind of have a hodgepodge of different things that I tell. And it might be some things that Joe said. It might be some things that I learned from researching Joe Yarzbinski. It might be some things that a customer came in and told me about their experience. But it all goes into this one revolving, ever-growing, living history.
That's why I think reenacting, you know, it's so valuable because it provides those nuances and those details that we're not going to find in a book, and we're not even going to find in someone's oral history. You know, I mean, you just have to see those things in action.
Yeah,
I guess that's what I'm trying to say to get it. Mm-hmm. You know, what things sort of look like, sound like, smell like, the tiny details of how clothing moves or equipment moves and
doesn't move
and stuck in the mud. That's the stuff that we do see in movies. And you said something interesting earlier about how Hollywood can sometimes drive the themes in the reenacting mm-hmm. world. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing being a history buff. Yeah, that's what I am. That's one of my hobbies. Because it exposes people to something they may have never thought of before. World War II, for example, you know, the biggest thing was you had your different World War II movies, you know, right after World War II with popular Audie Murphy and things like that. And it kind of like fell off. And then, you know, Saving Private Ryan came out. Everyone's seen Saving Private Ryan. Everyone knows Saving Private Ryan. And it brought that first level of, although not necessarily historically accurate, it still brought that personal level. You know, you follow these eight different characters trying to find this one character. And, you know, you have the ups and the downs and the death and the carnage and the triumph. It puts it on a personal level that you can relate to, i.e. the romantic side of it, but it still drives that. And then you get a new movie that comes out like Fury, you know, Brad Pitt standing up on top of a tank and the final, the last hurrah, you know, I'm going to defend to the last man. And, you know, I definitely think that there's a level of reality to that. I did not serve. I come from a military family, but I know that they would do the exact same thing. You know, they would stand and fight until, you know, the last breath, and you kind of see that and it's captured. And then we portray that on a different level of, you know, some guys will choreograph things, you know, if you're friends with a German or whatever, you know, you'd be like, hey, you know, when I get up here, we're going to wrestle around a little bit and, you know, do this and give it that little bit of a theatrical play. But also there's that level of reality of, you know, even though you're playing the part, it happened, you know, things like that. And that's the exciting part. And it gets people attracted on that level. You know, if you were to come to like D-Day Conneaut or Reading or a lot of these other events that happen all around, the camps are open to the public. You can walk around, you know, they have displays up, all the different weapons, the mechanized warfare, the tanks and things like that. And you can go around and see it. And that's always like one of the number one things resorted to is, you know, I watched Fury or I watched Inglourious Basterds and this and that. And how accurate is it? And truth is, Hollywood still reigns in those. You know, there's that Hollywood part that is not reality. But I think it's a good thing. It piques the interest of people and it gets them involved and it gets them excited. And it may get them out there and to do their own research on something they may have never thought of before.
Right. For sure. What you said about that kind of establishing a little bit of a personal connection there is very true. During the 2 days that I was at the D-Day reenactment, everything, the stuff I saw and everything, when we've interviewed our World War II vets who are in those areas and they say something, normally you would have no idea how to even begin to imagine that. But because I was in the middle of, you know, that group of guys charging up that beach, getting shot at by, you know, the fake German soldiers, I could kind of almost see it in my head of, you know, what it looked like. And it's really intense.
And a lot of the reenactments, you know, they have special services for the veterans, you know, World War II, Korea, all that. But being from Conneaut, you know, that was one of my bucket list things. You know, I wanted to participate. And that was one that really went deep into my like heart and soul, essentially. And walking off that beach and there's, you know, three ways off the beach, you know, up these couple steps or around the side. But, you know, then you're flanked by all these real World War II veterans, all these real Korean veterans and everything else. And they're sticking their hand out right in front of you to shake your hand or pat you on the back or, you know, thanking you for doing this. And, you know, you get back to the camp and you're all, you know, tired and sweaty and thirsty from, you know, running up a beach in a wool uniform in the 90 degree heat or hotter. They come over and they pull up a chair and sit down and they may tell you stories or just give you information and insight on stuff that they actually saw that they before may not have been able to put into words because no one would be able to understand it. But you're the closest thing he can relate to of actually being there, you know, being on the other end of a gun and running up, you know, even though it's fake, you know, you're shooting blanks, it's still, you know, you're on a different level that no one else can say they've done. They can't say that they've been on a landing craft and drove up and ran up a beach and did this, you know, not everyone can say that. So now you're on a relatable side. So they just kind of open up and tell you all these amazing things that is way better than any movie. If you're into it, you know, some people it's not for them to hear the carnage and the gore, but you know, it kind of comes with the territory when you're in this hobby, you know, is to see that and hear it, but also understand it on the level of that.
So the reenacting not only inspires and educates you as a participant, the reenactor, but also those who are watching, they are affected by it too. And they engage you and there's a dialogue that comes out of this, right? This is really fascinating. This to me is really, I think, interesting engagement of a particular narrative or particular story, you know, around military history that's, you know, it's three-dimensional, as we mentioned earlier. And I don't think you can get that kind of engagement in other ways.
No, not at all. And some of the things that I've done outside of just reenacting was at the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh. They did a night at the museum for like 300 Boy Scouts. They had a beautiful World War II exhibit and, you know, we were all dressed up and we were there and had to pretend like we were mannequins, you know, not move. And, you know, they came in and, you know, they kind of saw you, you kind of stand, you know, you're a living person. You stand out more than a mannequin. But, you know, the first thing they want to do is hold your gun and put your helmet on and, you know, oh, what other, you know, weapons do you have and this and that. And, you know, that's the fun part. And then there's the different part too of, you know, what do you know about World War II, you know, since that's the topic. And they're like, oh, you know, I know this and this. And, you know, it's cut and dry. And even though they're young men and women, you're still almost like intervening at a young age for them to realize that there's more out there and to find out and question things a little more and find that answer that, you know, you may be looking for, you know, inside yourself.
And that's really what we can hope for when we do this kind of work. You with reenacting, we do the oral history work, is that it inspires people.
Yes.
To want to know more, to go out there and find out more. And of course, those resources are out there.
Yes.
I'm very happy when people get inspired by the work that we do and can, you know, launch into a sort of a pathway towards a deeper understanding of these very complex eras in our history.
Yeah.
Right. And you know that by, mm-hmm. I mean, these are very complex situations and events and yeah, when we stop and realize that, it's like, whoa, this, it gives us a deeper appreciation for what people really went through.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. And like I said before, and then when you can bring it home and do this research and actually almost give a gift to a family that had no idea, that they may have always been curious about, but just never questioned, you know, that's the coolest part. You know, that really is. That's really neat. And, you know, like my friend Joe, to for his stories that he's told me that I know he hasn't really told anyone else, maybe a couple people, you know, that's something I'll carry the rest of my life, along with some of the things that I think is comical as being a few generations removed from him is some things that were completely relevant to him at my age. I'm like, you know, Joe, what are you talking about? I, you know, explain a little more. And there are some things that I ask him that he doesn't understand, you know, and that's the age gap sometimes, but that kind of makes it fun, you know, a little more of a conversation and go a little deeper. And then you discover who this person really is. You actually care for this person. They're not just your uncle or, you know, grandfather or something. You know, you genuinely care for what they did, what they experienced, and they didn't think twice about it, and they just did what they had to do.
We'll return shortly to our conversation with Bob Rivers, World War II reenactor. You are listening to episode 27 of Veteran Voices, the podcast. To learn more about us and to access our online collection of veteran stories, visit our websites, veteranvoicesofpittsburgh.com and veteransbreakfastclub.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Our nonprofit mission is to create communities of listening around local veterans and their stories through public storytelling programs and oral history interviews so that veterans of all eras and branches of service can preserve and share their memories in their own words. Thousands of local veterans, their families, and the public have participated in our storytelling events and Veterans Oral History Project. No one else in the region does what we do to recognize and honor the veterans of Western Pennsylvania, but we need your help. Please support our nonprofit mission by becoming an underwriter or by making a tax-deductible donation. Here's how. Visit veteranvoicesofpittsburgh.com or veteransbreakfastclub.com where you can make a secure online donation. Let's return now to our conversation with Bob Rivers, a World War II reenactor who portrays his late grandfather, Joe Yarzabinski. We are here at National Grind Coffee Shop in Elwood City, which Bob runs with his wife, Jackie. And so if you hear a little noise in the background, those are cars and trucks and things coming by the shop. And we encourage you to stop by the coffee shop when you're in Elwood City at 400 Lawrence Avenue. Right, Bob?
Yes, sir.
And certainly we encourage people to go on Facebook and give you a like there so they can keep on top of what's happening here.
Most definitely.
You do more than just coffee, right?
Oh, yes. Coffee, tea, all kinds of lattes. Usually have a few different non-caffeinated beverages that are seasonal. And that's one thing that I kind of pride myself on here is everything's either house-made or as local as possible. So it not only supports me, but it supports other small businesses. You know, to be conscious of where you spend your money and things like that not only helps you, but it helps the community that you live in.
Well, Bob makes a mean cappuccino and espresso, I'll tell you that.
Good.
And do you do yoga here?
I do yoga in here. I do not teach the class. I have a friend that's a customer of ours that is certified in teaching, and she comes in about once a month, twice a month, and we do like a yoga class in here. We do open mic nights. Just last Saturday, we had a pop-up boutique for Lovely Clover. It's like a woman's clothing that a friend of ours owns. It's mostly online, but it's still, you know, we try to get involved with as many community-oriented things as we possibly can, because one, that's what a coffee shop is community involvement. But also, as you know, we're all here for each other. If you don't partake in your community, then that's the repercussions of not doing it, is there's nothing going on, and you know, you build your own community with what you support and do.
Just awesome. Brian, you want to chime in?
You know, I had something, but it just completely just...
See, when I run out of stuff to say, I turn to Brian.
I love it.
Let's talk a little bit about Joe.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about him, where he served, what you know about some of his experiences, and how your reenacting of Joe has affected the family. You touched upon it a little bit earlier, but I'd like to get a little more deeply into it.
Yeah, most definitely. So what I do know, you know, again, it's kind of hard with military records and things like that being destroyed. And unfortunately, his seems to be one of them with the lack of information that is found on the internet, because a lot of the stuff is public information. For anyone listening, if you maybe have a family member that you don't know anything about, and you can request that information. You know, even a simple Google search will yield a lot of pathways to find that if you're ever curious about it. And don't give up. Just keep looking, and you know, you'll find it, and you'll bring a lot of closure, and you know, you'll I'm guaranteed to find something that you had no idea about, which is really neat.
Is that what happened with Joe's story? Did you research his life, his unit, and
so I started. You know, when I met my wife 6 years ago, you know. You go through the courting process and all that, and then you could definitely get into a serious relationship, and you meet the parents and stuff, and the family, and the aunts and the uncles and all that. And I always expressed my love for history and mostly World War II, and like my dad would have loved you, you know, he was in World War II, things like that. And it kind of piqued the curiosity to dig a little more and ask the uncles, did he ever talk about it? What did he say? You know, things like that. And you kind of, they're little pieces to the puzzle that you're constantly putting together. And you might put it in your unconscious mind and, you know, not think about it. And then when I really started diving into the reenacting, it was, you know, almost a side project. When you get tired of scouring eBay and Craigslist ads for surplus uniforms and things like that, it was, you know, kind of filled the time and gave you that little bit of a purpose to keep doing it. It's you can go out there and buy everything you need, you know, if you have a lot of money. But the reality is, you know, most of us don't have, you know, $2,000 to buy a Garand and $200 to buy a jacket, plus the uniforms and blanks and tents and, you know, everything that goes along with it, which is all, you know, self-funded. You buy it yourself. So, you know, it kind of filled the gap and kept it going for me anyways, to not get burnt out of, you know, looking at pages and pages and pages of, you know, pup tents, you know, just to find the right one to sleep in at the right price. You know, it sounds stupid, but it does. It can be a lot to take on for something that you've never done before.
And you have some of Joe's actual artifacts?
No uniforms. He didn't. The only thing that I ever was able to find of his were like his sergeant patches off of his uniform. Some of the things were given to me by other family of my personal family members that were like a great uncle. Like I have a United States Marine Corps K-bar that was issued, and it was like a great uncle's, that just, you know, here you have it, a pair of binoculars from my one grandfather who's since passed on, but his brother was in the Signal Corps from Rochester, New York. And it just so happened that these binoculars were made by some, I can't remember the name of the optical company in Rochester, New York. So now it's, you know, it's kind of like a personal connection to be issued something that was made in your hometown. It's pretty cool. And he's kept them. And, you know, since my grandfather passed on, you know, they pass it on to me. So I've almost built a few things in my collection of, you know, family things that were, you know, given or picked up through the years that makes it, again, more personal than just a pair of binoculars or a K-bar or things like that. But Joe, he didn't really have too much that I know of, which, you know, led to more of the mystery and more puzzle pieces and finding it out. So, again, a simple search to just search his name and find where he was, what he did. And, I was able to find out that he was in the 14th Armored Division, the 62nd Armored Infantry, which is pretty neat. And there was actually, I can't remember the name of it, but there was a book written, a gentleman still alive, he was wounded. And I tried to reach out to him to see, you know, any of his recollections or anything like that, if he'd be willing to talk. His grandson got back to me and just said, you know, he's kind of older and doesn't fully understand computers and technology, so it's a little more difficult. But through that, I was able to, you know, even find where he enlisted. He enlisted on the 19th of November in 1942, and he had to drive all the way to Erie, Pennsylvania, which, to put that in perspective, is probably about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes north from where Elwood City is located, which is a pretty long haul now to enlist in the Army, let alone back in 1942.
Why did he have to go to Erie?
That I'm not too sure. It could be regionally. I asked my friend Joe about it, and he said he had to go to Pittsburgh to enlist. So it could just be maybe the recruiting stations of, that I'm not really 100% sure about. So, you know, that one I unfortunately don't have an answer for.
That's interesting.
Oh, I mean, most definitely.
Recruiting station might have been at capacity or something. They didn't have any personnel to...
Could be.
To whatever, and then that was the closest one that was open or...
Yep, could be.
Well, we've had veterans tell us that probably the best way to put it is they didn't get satisfaction at the particular recruiting station. So they went to another and they got into the service they wanted or the job they wanted.
Yep. Or they were able to, you know, forge their age or something like that, you know.
Right.
Which is really neat that he was able to do that. And I do know that through his military records that he was in the, quite a few battles, like almost like turning, you know, some major conflicts in the war, of like the Battle of the Rhineland and the Ardennes Forest and things like that. And it's kind of neat that even on the discharge papers, they limit it to, you know, just that Ardennes, Alsace, throughout Central Europe. So, you know, now it's, you know, throughout Central Europe, that's not like you don't have it narrowed down to 4 square miles. It's Europe's pretty big. So that's pretty cool.
But, you know, here's the, I think the real value in knowing at least a unit is that those histories are out there. You're right. I mean, there are right down to the after action reports that are, you know, still, you know, you can get them online in many cases. So when you read those things and you know that someone, in this case, Joe, was in that unit, well, you can just sort of connect the dots and you can say, well, this is what he saw. This is what he experienced, you know, and you can find those places on a map. You can see the photographs and then you know that this is what he saw.
Yeah.
Right. And that really brings stuff to light again.
Most definitely. And that was one of the things that one of Jackie's uncles shared with me, that he told a story about how they were almost in a convoy, you know, heading to the next town, and they were all pretty much ambushed and, you know, confusion and everything everywhere, and you know, a firefight ensued, and this, and there was an 88 that took out, you know, one of the cars, or the, I'm not 100% sure on that part, but you know, he kind of went around, and him and a bunch of other guys, and you know, flanked the artillery that was going off, and you know, saved a lot of the guys that by doing that. And it was one of those things that I remembered, but then when I started looking at the after action reports from being narrowed down to the units, it's, you know, they would say that convoy under attack at 1200 hours, you know, taken out, you know, 2 hours later. And it starts piecing together again, that puzzle that's just, you know, all jumbled out there on the personal side, the internet, the war records and things like that. It puts it, it starts to come together. And then that builds me as a character going to these events like the Heinz History Center one. You know, I wasn't Bob Rivers. I was, you know, Joe, and I would bring that up, you know, oh, I'm from Elwood City. Like, where are you from? You know, who won the 1941 World Series? You know, things like that, that are almost like pop culture things that you get into. So it is almost like an act and it is a character, but it's also someone that's real life and relatable.
Well, how deeply do you go? I mean, it's, I mean, I ask this question because, I mean, obviously, you know, you know some facts and you know the time period. But do you get into some of the personality traits that your family can share with you about Joe?
Yeah, that's a great thing. That's something I'm going to have to ask, some personality traits, you know.
Like, was he left-handed, right-handed? Did he part his hair on this side?
Character quirks to kind of...
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great thing.
Further deepen the immersion into the part.
No, that's a great thing. That's something I'm going to have to bring up. That's a one part I didn't get to yet, you know. But that's, again, the fun part of doing it is constantly researching and refining your character. And some guys aren't into that. They're just into going out and essentially playing army and marching around and doing their thing. And some guys are really hardcore about it. And some guys are, you know, there's 100 different ways that you can go by being in this hobby.
Right, right.
And one thing that's really neat about this hobby is, you know, there's a lot of veterans in it. And one of my good friends and my wife's friend is Jason Neibauer. He got into World War II reenacting because he was in Afghanistan. He did see combat, and he was a part of the 4th Infantry. So that's kind of how we all got like hooked up together. But to him, that means a lot to kind of partake in something that there's no other way he can experience again, you know, different situations and camaraderie that we can mimic through this reenacting.
You mentioned before this hobby is just in very time consuming and very expensive.
Yes, yes.
So for somebody who would want to get into this, to sort of branch off and possibly explore this hobby, what advice could you give them?
Great question.
Do a lot of research first. A lot of the, not only of units, again, if you were to join a unit, these are guys that you're going to stay at their house. You're going to be in a car with them for 3 to 4 hours. You're going to be camped out with them. You are going to be spending a lot of time with them. So you don't want to be put into a group that you maybe don't agree with. Are you interested in a Ranger Division? Are you interested in the 29th Division? Are you interested in the 4th Division, like I'm a part of? Are you interested in an Armored Division? Do you have millions of dollars and want to buy a tank and, you know, start your own thing? You know, it's your own personal quest, but knowledge is power, and knowledge also saves you a lot of money when you want to get into the reenacting world. If we were all size 28 waist, we could find tons of original uniforms at a fair price. But the reality is we are, as Americans, are much bigger than we were at the time. So then you have to resort to originals, if you can find them, for a price, or reproductions. And there's a few websites out there and places that specialize in reproduction uniforms, both American and German. And
well, that's interesting. So you're saying that so we modern Americans, we have mm-hmm. to sort of adjust ourselves to the uniforms, because they were very different size-wise.
Yes, yes.
Back then. Most different. These were often, you know, guys in the military and either out of basic or, you know, out of war. You know, they were skinny guys and they mm-hmm. were fit and trim. And yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about that.
And, you know, one thing that Joe brought up before too was one of the guys in his squadron never owned a pair of shoes. That's one reason why he joined. He joined and he didn't have to worry about not eating. He didn't have to worry about a dry season to farm. You know, there was a lot of, it was a different time. And that's one of the things that being a history person we run into constantly is, how can people portray Germans? How can people be Confederate soldiers? How can people do this and that? And it's unfortunately, they're looking at it from the wrong angle. You're looking at it from a modern point of view of what we know mm-hmm. in this very moment, not what was relevant in 1861, not what was relevant in 1942 or 1939 or 1959. You know, and sometimes that gets in the way of the relevancy.
In our project, we create a space where veterans can tell their story in their own words. So often veterans, you know, they're reliving those experiences, and sometimes their language is, it fits accordingly. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? So, for example, I was miking up a World War II veteran who was a Marine officer, went through the Pacific Islands. And if you've ever seen those photographs and video films of hand-to-hand combat with flamethrowers and so forth in the Pacific, it's brutal stuff. So Mr. Myers was a Marine officer. He was the first to go through that often in his unit. So he says to me, "Son, can I say Japs?" Mm-hmm. He said, "My daughter's a teacher. She asked me to come to her classroom. And she said, Dad, when you speak to the children, don't use the word Japs. We don't say that today." And he said to me, and I'll never forget his face when he was telling me this. He was so sincere. He said, "Can I say Japs?" And I said, "Well, Mr. Myers, you know, it's your story. If that's how you want to refer to the Japanese, you know, by all means, go ahead." And, you know, he did. And his story really bore out some of the horrific things that he went through with the Japanese. I mean, brutal stuff. So along those lines, do some reenactors take it that far where they the filters come off, you know, our modern day filters, a political yeah. correctness, if you will, and they refer to the Krauts and the Japs and the, you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, most definitely.
That was a long setup for that.
Yeah, no. It's a... I understand what you're saying. That's more of a personal thing. You know, if someone comes up to into our tent and wants to, you know, tell me about the 4th Infantry Division and this and that, you know, we're not going to start throwing out these derogatory comments. But that doesn't mean that you're not friends with a German soldier and, you know, you kind of rag on them a little more than, you know, personally than what you would lead the public on to know. You know, and there's a little bit of humor that goes along with it. A lot of these guys will understand it. And that's why it's kind of within the group, you know, of reenactors as a hobby.
Oh, that's an in-group thing. Those sort of dynamics.
Essentially, yeah. So like it's something that maybe I could say to a comrade in my unit, or I could say to, you know, some German guy and they'll laugh and, you know, haha, you know, shake it off or whatever. But it's not something that you would say. There's definitely like a politically correctness, but there's also the reality of it. Unfortunately, I personally think politically correctness is trying to wash away a lot of things. Just like my friend Joe, like he refers to them as Japs. And he's like, "That's what they are." And it wasn't until he said that, I'm like, you know, you're right. They are. They're Japanese. They're just like, I'm sure they have some slang word for us as Americans. And it wasn't until he brought that up that I was like, you know what? It's true. That's what they were. They were the enemy to us, just like we were the enemy to them. And that goes a long way. And you have to put that in a level of comprehension when you do this that the general public won't understand. But if I were to say to you, you know, "I don't like these questions. You're, you know, interrogating me like Stalin was, you know, are you going to, you know, come take me out, essentially. You know, it's like something that a history person would understand and, you know, may get a kick out of and take it with a grain of salt. Whereas like maybe another person's, you know, would take it a lot more seriously to a literal interpretation rather than like what it is.
Well, that's a very interesting dynamic, I think, because, you know, at bottom line, and I've had many veterans put it this way, war and soldiering is about killing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. It's brutal business. So, and maybe this was sort of what I didn't understand early on when I didn't think highly of reenacting. You know, how do you take that, you know, the brutality of war, the nature of war, and then go into pretend world with it? You know, how do you, I mean, obviously there's a level of sanitization that one has to do, a filter that has to be put on there, because, you know, we can't obviously reenact the brutality of war faithfully, you know what I'm saying?
Most definitely. And that comes back to, I talked to a guy in my unit about, you know, this podcast that we were doing, and I was like, how can I portray some of these things that we experience that the general public may not know, and for people to, veterans, you know, World War II veterans or whatever, to understand what we do, that we're not, you know, just going out there and poking fun or, you know, trying to, what they may see as like a dishonor, you know, we're actually, it's quite the opposite. We try to honor them. Just like you quoted, it's no matter how hard we try, you know, we can do everything in our power. We still cannot fully capture what it's really like to be in a war zone, but we do the best of what we have to, replicate that on a level that, one, people will come out and see, one, that we enjoy at the same time. And we don't want to get hurt doing this stuff. You know, a lot of the things that we use, like the weapons, are 70 years old, 80 years old, you know, and they're all original or functioning and things like that, you know, so we can get hurt just as bad as anyone else can. You know, we go through a lot of safety checks to do that, and we have limits, and, you know, again, we all have to go to work tomorrow. So we do the best that we can with what we have available. And I think we do a pretty good job. If you've never been to a reenactment, it's something you'd have to experience. And don't, just like that old saying, don't knock it till you try it. You know, don't knock it until you actually go out there. And you don't have to come out, and you don't have to be vocal and do these things. But if you appreciate history by any means, or you are curious about it, it's definitely something you have to see on all levels, whether it's Revolutionary War. You know, I had a friend that does the French and Indian War, you know, and he literally runs around and he'll shave his head in the summer and run around in a loincloth with his face painted.
He's wow, not, that's hardcore.
Yeah,
that is hardcore.
He's not poking fun at Native Americans, but that's what they did, and it brings to life something that you may have never been exposed to before. And
yeah, again,
piques
an
interest.
It's that three-dimensional history. It's like, this is what it looks like and you sounds actually, like and moves
like.
You
see it, you hold it, and it's relatable at that point. It's not just a movie. It's not just a book.
Sure.
It's an experience.
Right, an experience.
You know, even my grandfather and Connie out there, he doesn't go to the battles all the time, you know, because it's been going on for so long. But he loves even just driving around during the whole week that the battle, you know, we kind of, it takes almost a week to set up for the 2-day battle with the climactic D-Day landing. And to him, it's his favorite time of year, because he's like, you know, I drive around and I see men dressed up in wool uniforms, and I see women dressed up in dresses, and, you know, their hair done up and a red lipstick. And, you know, he's like, I feel like I'm 10 years old again, you know, because that's what, you know, his recollection of his childhood was, because that's what it was, you know. So now it's like, even it's pretty neat to hear that and to be a part of this like invigorating memory that a lot of people have of better and worse. You know, my other grandfather, I talked to him about what he remembered, and he was rather young at the time. He was under 10, but he still remembers, you know, all the scrap drives that they would have. You know, pretty much anything that was metal would go. You know, even in Elwood here, I was told about they had this huge World War I cannon. I don't even know what it was. I just heard that it was huge, and they turned that into scrap. So it's like, you know, they're literally turning in memorials to pitch into the war effort. And my grandfather said that him and his friends would walk down the train tracks and pick the cotton out of the cattails and turn that in, and that they would use it as like stuffing in life jackets and possibly bandages and stuff like that, that, you know, they could almost loom it into something that was needed for the war effort. And I think that's kind of where World War II stands alone, that is a hot commodity with movies and things like that, is that's almost like the last conflict where everyone pitched in. The entire world was involved, whether it was on the good side or the bad side. You know, at home, you had women with victory gardens. She would take care of the four or five kids and then go work in a factory at night making ammunition or planes. You know, at the, I want to say it was Westinghouse retooled to make like torpedoes and bombs, and the Heinz company would retool to make rations and things like that. You know, it was like everything was put aside to defeat this genuine evil. After doing some research, it's almost like the last one that that happened where it was like almost okay. You know, we defeated the evil that we needed to defeat. You know, Korea came along and, you know, you had people that were like, you know, maybe we shouldn't be there. And it, you know, went into Vietnam and the Persian Gulf and Afghanistan and Iraq and all the, you know, everything that we deal with today. In World War II, it was what you did. You know, you joined the army, you did this, you grew a victory garden. Even if you were disabled, you still found some way to participate into the war effort. Whereas now it's like a drawn line, a political drawn line, due to the media and things like that, that talking to some old timers, you know, like my friend Joe and my grandparents and things like that, that you kind of start connecting the dots of reality, you know, of what happened.
We were a nation at war in World War II, of course, and very different than today. We're a military at war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we hope that, you know, through this conversation today that we can inspire people.
Most definitely.
To check out reenacting. So where could someone go and find out about reenactments here in our area?
Wherever you are, just kind of Google. Again, Google is your best friend. You know, it's the entire World Wide Web at your fingertips. Whether you're in Western PA, you can Google World War II reenactments around, you know, Pittsburgh, or, and, you know, it'll kind of hone in through the search engine results of what's around. And then, you know, once you go to one, it leads to another one, and it leads to another one, to where if you really wanted to as a reenactor, you could probably do something almost every month throughout the entire year.
Oh, really? There's that much going on.
Whether it's, if you're a reenactor, it may be a tactical out in for Indiana Town Gap, they do like Fig 1 and Fig 2. It's like a Battle of the Bulge in the middle of winter. You actually camp out, you know, things like that. You have Old Bedford Village that does one. And a lot of these places are ambidextrous. They don't just do World War II. They'll do Civil War. They may do Revolutionary War, you know, and there's really something for everybody, I think, within the reenacting world. Even if you're a woman or a child, you know, they have home front displays. You know, what did the women and children and you know, the older men do? What was expected of a discharged soldier? You know, just things like that. I mean, the sky's the limit with what you want to do and the information that's out there. And it's really fascinating.
You mentioned the displays about, like, if you're a woman or a child and you want to get involved. Whenever I was at Conneaut, it was more educational than I had ever anticipated it being, because not only did we get to see the D-Day reenactment and that stand, unfortunately, close to that Flak 88 you mentioned, ears are ringing for about an hour, but in the encampments that they had, there was an Axis camp, a French camp, a British camp, American camp. We actually, my camera crew and I walked around and just talked to all of the people who were there, and we just basically got history lessons on everything that they had, the equipment, the medical stuff, the uniforms, just all this stuff. And we came out of there feeling like we just went through like an AP college course, and it was awesome.
And it's all hands-on. You're intrigued even more than just seeing a display or seeing a poster board with a bunch of information on it.
I feel very sorry for the people who had to lug the Thompson submachine gun around.
Yeah, for sure. That, well, even the Garand at 11.77 pounds fully loaded is pretty heavy to march all the way through Europe.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, yeah. When you can hold this stuff in your hands, boy, you get a whole
new
sense
appreciation for it.
Sure. I remember the first time when we started this, first time we had some artifacts with us at Soldiers and Sailors, Mike Krause there, the curator, brought in a grease gun. And, you know, we had a fellow come in who actually carried a grease gun. You know, to see him hold that was one thing, but to hold it, you know, myself, and to think about what that must have been like to carry that. And they're heavy, you know, to carry that around. Oh, my goodness. That was a whole other kind of education.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And like how you said about the displays at these major reenactments, not all reenactments have really displays like that. But the major ones do. And then you do get this veteran that did come over, even like my grandfather, who was like one of them served pre-Vietnam, and he carried a Garand. And he was like, oh, you know, all the tricks of the trade, essentially, of owning a Garand, which I own and reenact with. you know, it's like they never left. It's so ingrained because they were so dependent on that. Joe over here would tell me about the thousands and thousands of rounds in their B-24, the waist gun, the tail gun, the 30 cal, the 50 cal, and how they would check each and every round before they went up on a bombing mission to make sure, you know, because if one bullet is just out of link enough, you know, it's going to jam up the whole thing and you don't have time for a jam. You know, it's definitely, it does make you like smile a little bit when you see them and like their eyes light up when
they
come right over and they're like, oh, I remember carrying this. And, you know, oh, you know, my friend Jim so-and-so from Des Moines, Iowa, or, you know, whatever, you know, our unit had this. And, you know, it's really neat. And it opens up the gates to find out, you know, their story. And that's the one thing too, is like in Elwood City here too, is we recently, in as of 2012, have a Medal of Honor recipient, Leslie Sabo. He was killed in Cambodia. And in my coffee shop here, they actually did a filming with two of the guys that were in his platoon when he was killed. And even up to a modern day, that was really powerful how we talked about like people starting to reenact the Vietnam War. The different level of veterans, some come in and, you know, I did what I had to do. I have no remorse. You know, what am I supposed to do in that situation? You know, die or be killed and this and that. And then there's some guys that repress it so far that they bring it back and they're insanely full of emotion. And to sit here and witness that was probably one of the turning points too, to get me started reenacting, is to keep that emotion going. Even though it's something that he repressed, it's still something that happened. And you know, Leslie Sabo was given the Medal of Honor for that, for his sacrifice, but it's not just forgotten. You know, after that day, they dedicated the local high school auditorium, the Leslie H. Sabo Auditorium, and some kids came in and they were like, oh, you know, we had some stupid assembly over something I didn't pay attention to. And I was like, well, why didn't you pay attention to it? And they really didn't have any answer. And that was really frustrating to me as like a living historian on any front and just being a history buff, is, you know, there's a lot of local history that people don't realize. No matter where you're from, there's some sort of local history that you can tap into. And there's reasons to tap into it. And I think that that's definitely one of them, is so Leslie's sacrifice wasn't forgotten. And to have his friends actually come to his hometown from, I can't remember where this one friend was, way down south, had a southern drawl and everything, you know, it was almost hard to understand because he had such a thick southern accent. You know, that's powerful to them. And by doing these things and doing that TV show that they filmed, it keeps that legacy going. And it's the same thing that we do almost on a daily basis. You know, I would be shocked if you were to ask any reenactor if they didn't check eBay or any history source or anything like that daily for something that piqued their interest, or, you know, some sort of equipment that, you know, they're eyeing up. You know, it's definitely something that encapsulates your life every day.
Well, Bob, I'm going to start referring to you as a living historian. I'm going to take your cue. Right?
All right.
Well,
that's a great way
to put that.
But I'm still a novice. So, you know, okay. Still, there's always something to learn. No one's ever an expert.
Thank you so much for sharing what it is that you do to tell these stories in the three-dimensional way that reenacting brings about. This has been a really fascinating podcast for me, very different than a lot of other things that we've done, as I mentioned earlier. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me and interviewing me. And I hope, you know, I'm able to give some insight on what we do and get some people out there, veterans and novices alike, to get interested in the hobby that we participate in and, you know, take a lot of time and care for. Anyone interested, the Reading Air Show is coming up. It is June 4th to the 7th. And they have a website, is www.maam.org. And D-Day Conneaut is August 19th and 20th. And their website is www.ddayohio.us. And, you know, those are probably the two biggest ones that happen. There's a lot of smaller ones, but you definitely want to go and check them out if you can or if it interests you. And if you're interested in joining a unit or anything, just kind of Google, you know, the 29th Infantry. I know there's a couple guys locally in Elwood City that are part of that. Out of Erie, PA, there's like the 99th Infantry, the Battle Babies. I'm part of the 4th Infantry Division. Check them out. Just Google, you know, if you're interested in the 4th Infantry Division, we have it's the furious4th.weebly.com, or check us out at Facebook at the Furious 4th World War II Living History Group. So, you know, we always put information up there, reenactments coming up, reenactments that have passed with photographs and everything like that. So, you know, it definitely can be that the foot in the door to what we do.
And here's what I would add, that people should come by your coffee shop.
Yes,
come down
yes.
to National Grind Coffee here, 400 Lawrence Avenue in Elwood City, and talk to you in person.
Yes. You know, and that's one thing that opened up. The local newspaper did an article, and the amount of veterans that have been coming in and showing me things and sharing their stories, you know, some of the things that you see is just, it's just fantastic. You know, like, it's not every day that you see an original confidential invasion map of Okinawa. You know, it's pretty neat. It's pretty cool.
Thanks, Bob.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to a production of the Social Voice Podcast Network.